南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Are you in good health? Are you secure? I trust that you are. I hope that you are. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your practice. Joining the Buddhist revolution. Yeah? I decided this morning that that's a meme that I want circulating. Buddhist revolution. This world, the politics and societies of the planet right now, man, if they don't need revolution, I don't know what. There's so much greed and manipulation and misinformation. Oh my goodness. But you know, that's what all the clicks and media and dollars are about. Putting in our faces all the time. What about all the tremendously wonderful, great, helping hands, incredible people like you doing things to help other human beings as they manifest their greater potential in life? Yeah? Why don't we ever hear about that? Why don't we hear about the Buddhist revolution going on this planet? It's happening, folks. And you're an integral part of it. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah? All right. Langavatara. I tell you, the more we read this Langavatara, and we're getting closer, we're 3/4 of the way through at least. The more we read this challenge between Mahamati, the personage of all students of Shakyamuni, and Shakyamuni's constant address to getting over the hump of attachment and identification, that there is something else, something that's driving us all the time, but we don't tend to pay attention to it. Buddhist revolution, yeah? It's personal. It's internal. It's our mind. The Lankavatara for me is a perfect example, really, I'll say a perfect example of Shoju with some Shakyamuni. Because this whole book is Mahamati. Stubborn. He wants to know. He's seeking. He's a seeking mind. He's not just standing in opposition and going, yeah, whatever, screw you, you know. Yeah, whatever. He's like, man, my brain is really attached to this stuff. And you're telling me that I can, with my mind, something that I can perceive and experience the world without my brain? And Shakyamuni, no. I'm not trying to get rid of your brain. I'm just trying to get you to see around it, over it, underneath. Just incorporate your brain with this broader, larger vision, understanding that your brain is a part of something much larger. And you can live in your mind in that larger space. And guess what? When you do that, all of the stuff that your warehouse, your database, your brain is obsessing about becomes non-stressful, at least less stressful. Your anxieties, they don't seem based in... Do you remember when you were a little kid and you did something wrong? And you would say, you could hear yourself say this to other kids. My mom's going to kill me. My dad's going to kill me. Now, we think of those things as childhood silliness, stupidity. But listen to the words. We really, to varying degrees, we believed what we were saying. We were literally going to be killed. Think about that. Think about when you were going through puberty and everything that occurred in your environment was cataclysmic. From super high wow experience to, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I can't survive this. Remember those emotions, those hormones or whatever, those moments of utter, utter devastation. If you ever wondered what the monkey mind is about, as an adult, assuming we survive those stages of our lives, as adults, we can look back on those experiences. If we can even really remember, we package them up as, I exaggerated a lot. I didn't understand. I didn't know. Right? Again, Shakyamuni's words just keep ringing out. Everything changes. Everything's in progress. Everything's just manifesting potential. So why would it be so difficult for us to understand that if we unlock our Buddha-ness, our Buddha mind, that we would have the same kind of a paradigm shift, that we would look back onto our current life of obsessing and stressing and anxiety with the compassion of an older, more mature mind, thinking, oh, man, yeah. I used to really torture myself, but, you know, there's a bit of a humor in that now that I don't do that anymore. And there's a little bit of a larger sense of self that encompasses other sentient minds, looking at them as, ugh, how hard it must be to be you. You don't need to be that way. You can... Right? How many parents have you heard tell their children, you'll understand in time, or some form of it, right? Wait till you grow up. Oh, you'll understand. And the child just looks at you like, huh? Total confusion, right? They have no measure. They have. Why do we expect them to have? But just the notion that things will change in time is often enough for a child to go, okay, I love you. I'm dependent upon you. I trust you for now. So I will adopt the mindset. I will believe that this will change over time, but I'm skeptical, right? Well, a lot of people are that way in about Buddhism or in their Buddhist practice. This is where our compassion leads us to patience and understanding, because each one of us has to come to this maturity on our own, right? You can't package puberty and shove it into somebody's body, mind, brain, whatever, and then wake up the next day with, now I understand. I'm a sexual being and that's all I can think about. Oops, attachment. I don't know. We're funny, we humans. And yet, our capacity, we barely tap into it. With our practice of enlightenment, of waking up that Buddha-ness, making it more prevalent in our daily activity, our daily beingness, let's start that Buddhist revolution, yeah? Starts with the revolution inside, doesn't it? All right. I don't know where that came from, but obviously I needed to say it, so thank you for listening. Back into the Lakavatara. We're still in chapter 6. This is a longer one than the last couple. And Mahamati says, as we often start these videos, it is again said by the Emancipated One that by fulfilling the six paramitas, Buddhahood is realized. What are the six paramitas? Have you ever asked that question? You see it all the time when we read different texts. And what the hell are you talking about? What are paramitas, right? Well, Mahamati's asking for us. And how are they fulfilled? Because I want that Buddhahood. You haven't told me what it is yet. I don't quite understand it. But you said these things will get me there. So tell me about those things. Ah, Mahamati. I'm starting to like him more. So, Shakyamuni says, Mahamati, there are three kinds of paramitas. Okay, so there's six paramitas and there's three kinds of paramitas. All right, here we go. What are the three? Well, they are the worldly, the superworldly, and the highest superworldly. We're stumbling over words here. We don't have the language to get us there, but hopefully, as he continues to speak on this, we'll get better clues. Am I too bright? I'm always worried about this lighting. It's ever changing. Anyway, of these Mahamati, the worldly paramitas are practiced like this. Adhering tenaciously to the notion of an ego soul and what belongs to it, that identification, you know, the things I keep talking, there's the different kinds of words saying the same thing. Identification is part of ownership, yeah? If I identify something, I identify myself in the process, therefore there's this entanglement of self and object, object justifying or indicating a self that can perceive it, right? Perceived perceiver immediately happening at the same time. We have different words for them, but it's the same act. And that's what he's saying is adhering tenaciously to the notion of an ego soul and what belongs to it. And holding fast to dualism. Those who are desirous for this world of form, etc., will practice the paramita of charity in order to obtain the various realms of existence. So this is the idea that within samsara, within dualism, we can do charitable acts, but that charity is based on, here, I have this, and I give it to you, therefore I gain merit. It's based on the dualism. It's based on the thing. Yeah? The ego. So this charity is based on mollifying the ego. But at the same time, it kind of grows the ego in a different direction, right? Look how benevolent I am. Let's go on. In the same way, Mahamati, the ignorant will practice the paramitas of morality, patience, energy, dhyana, prajna, attaining the psychic powers, they will be born in Brahma's heaven. We'll have gained enough gold stars that will qualify for heaven. a land, another place, right? How many religions are based on this? It's very samsarically based. As I have often said, all religions are a form of politics, social politics, in order to, and they're all based on the body, the physical world. And so the one who collects the most wins, period. I say a lot more than that about it, but as to the superworldly paramitas, they are practiced by the Shravakas and Pratyekabuddhas, whose thoughts are possessed by the notion of nirvana. So they just have a different goal. We're going to do all these things in order that we might attain some other kind of being outside of ourselves, or that our ego will be enraptured into this new perception of reality. But they maintain that body, right? They maintain the attachment, the identification. Again, I need to be careful with my words because I don't want to indicate nihilism or destruction or annihilating. It's about the mind's attachment to the warehouse, yeah? The paramitas of charity, etc., are thus performed by them who, like the ignorant, are desirous of enjoying nirvana for themselves. I will attain. Which is an implication that I, unlike the rest, will attain. Dualism, separateness, that's not equanimity. Again, Mahamari, as to the highest superworldly paramitas, they are practiced by the Bodhisattva Mahasattvas, who are the practicers of the highest form of spiritual discipline, or the mind's discipline. When you hear spiritual in Buddhism, it's talking about the mind. Are the practice of the highest form of spirit, that is, perceiving that there is nothing in the world but what is only seen of the mind itself. On account of discrimination and understanding that duality is of the mind itself, they see that the discriminations cease to function, the identification, and that seizing and holding is non-existent. Again, Buddhism is about the mind. The seizing and holding isn't a physical act. It's a mental act. By identifying, we are seizing and making an ownership, holding. And free from all thoughts of attachment to individual objects, which are of the mind itself, our relationship is of the mind itself, our identification is a mental construct. It doesn't affect. The chair doesn't feel more comfortable because it knows you own it. You see, you can go to the point of ridiculous here to understand what he's actually saying. And in order to benefit and give happiness to all sentient beings, my development into Buddhiness, bodhisattvaness, is not only my perceptive liberation, but it directly affects everything I am in, a part of, my environs, my friends, my... you've heard me say this. Some of you have emailed me, how do I chant for... Yes, I know, Sylvain Sifu... to chant for things is silliness. That's not our Buddhist goal. But what about other people? I want to chant for them. No, you want to chant for your enlightenment, because the more you enlighten yourselves, you do enlighten them. This is how others become enlightened, by your influence, not with words, with action. action, energy, karma. It's a simple formula. And by adjusting, by cultivating your karma of enlightenment, remember your environment. We do, every time you do Gongyo, you read in the meditations that our environments is a reflection of ourselves, our beingness. So flip that around. If your beingness achieves higher and higher maturity, inclusiveness, equanimity, then your environment must reflect that. The only higher step to your own Buddhist development, here it is, write it down, is that as you influence your environment, people will be curious. People will want to know, what is it about you? They may be practicing and seek you out for advice. They may be completely ignorant of Buddhism and seek you out for advice. This is the Bodhisattva path. This is when you have an opportunity to say, come chant with me. Come experience what I experience for yourself. Let me open this door of self-discovery for you. I can't give you anything. I can't show you what this is like. I can't push this idea into your brain. You're the one. You're the only one who can experience this amazing living being. Buddhism is a training for the mind. Right? You would do it with anything else. How do you broaden your shoulders? How do you get, you look so healthy. While I do 50 push-ups every morning. Oh man, what's a push-up? How do you do them? Well, come do some push-ups with me. I'll show you how I do it. And then you're on your own. It's up to you to do the push-ups in whatever way you do them. Come do the push-ups with me. I will support your activity in push-ups. But ultimately, I can't put the shoulders and the musculature and the breathing and all of that in, no matter how much I talk about it. You have to do the push-ups. And you will discover the benefit of the push-ups for yourself. It's that simple. You don't have to read all of these books and be a master communicator. Namo Myoho Renge. If you can do that, you're Bodhisattva. Lead other people to do it for themselves. Right? The Bodhisattva practice of the Paramita of charity. That's charity of a different sort, isn't it? That charity isn't, you're not losing anything of yourself in order to give it to somebody else, if we're going to use the same words, right? All other forms of charity are of a sort of a negotiation of stuff. I have this, let me give it to you. Doesn't that make me wonderful? That's all duality, ego. But the Bodhisattva says, I am on a path. I am exercising my mind to live in Myoho Rengekyo, to live in Buddhaness. If you sense something from that, and I believe you must, or you wouldn't be in my environment, then let me facilitate, let me show you how to do this for yourself. Am I actually losing anything, giving anything? All I'm doing is supporting the very thing I'm doing, and I'm inviting you to do the same. That charity, there is no negotiation of stuff. There's just sharing the light. That's bodhisattva. Or as it's termed here, as the, highest superworldly. Superworldly in this case being outside of the worldliness of possessions and ownership and et cetera, right? While dealing with an objective world, there is no rising in them or of discrimination. They just practice morality, and this is the paramita of morality. The way you are, the way you hone yourself to be the best being that you can be, is morality, is benevolence, is charity, all of these other worldly terms. They're really not the same thing, are they?
Same thing.
To practice patience with no thought of discrimination rising in them, and yet with full knowledge of grasp and grasping, this is the paramita of practice or patience. Right? If you're not losing anything, giving anything, getting anything, then patience becomes something of an observer, an appreciator of effort. Again, there's no exchange here. There's just a different level of being, a much more mature level of being. To exert oneself with energy from the first part of the night to its end, and in conformity with the disciplinary measures, and not to give rise to discrimination, this is the paramita of energy. How do you live your life? I mean, he's saying it explicitly, energy here. He's talking about karma, right? Not to cherish discrimination, not to fall into the philosopher's notion of nirvana. This is the paramita of dhyana, penetrating understanding, yes? As to the paramita of prajna, when the discrimination of the mind itself ceases, when things are thoroughly examined by means of intelligence, there is no falling into dualism, and a revulsion takes place at the basis, while previous karma is not destroyed. When transcendental knowledge is exercised for the accomplishment of self-realization, then there is the paramita of prajna, living your life in the experience of living your full expression of karma, life-affirming expression of karma, not letting it fall into dualism and this, not that, but just a full experience of the momentum of one's karmic life within the whole, not separate. See, the ego disappears when we do that. It's not that we lose ourselves. It's that we cease to be so identified, separate. It's a mental exercise, right? These Mahamati are the paramitas and their meanings. So there you have it. They're modes of, you could say they're modes of behavior, but doesn't behavior, as I was talking at the beginning of this video, in different stages of our lives, we can look to our child, our teenager, our adult years, young adult years, and we could see how the very same, we're doing the same thing. We're living our lives. We're waking up each morning. We're going to sleep at night. We're eating food. We're doing stuff. That never changes. But our mind of understanding about when we're a child, everything's about me, 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 me. That's our whole world. As we develop into teenagers, our world rapidly expands. Does it physically expand? No, it's a mental expansion, yeah? So violent is this change in our mind that we rebel against what we perceive to be the limitations that we are the ones who held those limitations. But we blame our parents or our sisters or our whatevers or society for having kept us blind, but we're the ones who were blind. We adopted those things as the rules of being. And then as we mature, we break free of those things as though they were imposed upon us. But we're the ones who imposed it upon us. Isn't that funny? And on we go. Why do we have such political fury right now about anything? Because the behavior of human beings is to feel as though the universe, life, stuff, rules are imposed upon us. The universe is happening to us. Life sucks, then you die because it's happening to us. That's so juvenile. And yet the world is juvenile. Life, the universe, all of it is happening for us. To observe it and be amazed by it. That shift of perspective is incredibly liberating because now we don't have the obstacle of life. We have the engagement of life. Namo myoho renge kyo. All right. So it is said. And now we're going to go into that verse portion. And this will be the end of the sixth chapter. So, the created are empty, impermanent, momentary. So the ignorant discriminate the meaning of momentariness is discriminated by means of the analogies of a river, a lamp, of seeds. All things are non-existent. They are not momentary, quiescent, not subject to destruction, and unborn. This, I say, is the meaning of momentariness. What he's identifying is the difference between momentariness of an experience versus momentariness of a solid, static, extant thing. Yes, the things are there to be sure, but it is the mind we're talking about. And when the mind perceives things as, even if you understand them intellectually as constructions that are instantiating moment to moment, you're still identifying them as other. And so the penetrating wisdom of suchness is inclusive, is that we're all moving, we're all atoms, we're all photons, we're all energy moving through time. Isn't this amazing? All things are non-existent. They are not momentary, quiescent, not subject to destruction and unborn, I say, is the meaning of momentariness. Birth and death succeed without interruption. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, moment, 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 moment. This I do not point out for the ignorant. Owing to the uninterrupted succession of existence, discrimination moves on in the six paths, the six lower realms, hell, hunger, animality, so on. Yeah. Oh, by the way, this might be a good point. I'm going to direct you once again to threefoldlotus.com, the home/home.htm page of the, and there's a link on the first page of the website, to core study materials. There are links in there to all of these basic concepts, the nine consciousnesses that I talk about all the time, and all of this. Ignorance is the cause, and there is the general rising of minds. When form is not yet born, where is the abode of the middle existence. And here we're talking about the middle way, right? Something that Nagarjuna would develop tremendously a few hundred years later, yeah? This idea that we exist in a samsaric body, but with the Buddha mind. That the Buddha mind can seem like something other, but in practice, we can combine the two, right, in the middle. Have our Buddha-ness and our cake and eat it too. If another mind is set in motion in an uninterrupted succession of deaths, which birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, where does it find its dependence as form is not established in time? Here we go with that time thing that Shakyamuni is always talking into around that concept of what is time. It's mired in the idea of instantiations, yes? But there is an aspect of Buddha-ness, enlightenment, that broader sense of everything is in motion that kind of destroys the idea of time as a succession of permanent things. Time is a moving needle. Just observing energies roiling through time is different than time as in past, present, future. That is, yes, a construction, but it was a construction before and it's still there. No. That's where things break. Right? The chair that was there last year is no longer here. The chair that is here now. See, that's the Mahamati problem. If mind is set in motion somewhere, somehow the cause is an unreal one. It is not complete. How can one know of this momentary disappearances? The attainment of the mendicants, the practitioners, gold, the Buddha relics, and the heavenly palace of the Abhasvara are indestructible by any worldly agencies. In other words, this mind of perception doesn't hold to a specific time, to a specific place, to a past, present, or future. It's an engagement in the process. It's free of moments, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Because birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, that's duality. Ever abiding are the truths attained by the Buddhas and their perfect knowledge. The nature of Buddhahood as realized by them, how can there be momentariness in them? The city of the Gandharvas, Maya-like forms, how can they be otherwise than momentary? Realities are characterized with unreality, and how can they be casual agencies? Again, could seem like word salad, right? But take your time and understand this is that dividing line between the attached, entangled existence and the observer, witness of the entire process. I don't like perceiver because it implies a perceived, but enlightenment isn't about being in a different place. It's about being within the entire experience. Words are, They're full of barbs, aren't they? All right, so that ends chapter 6. We're going to chart new ground in chapter 7. And of course, we'll start with a question, which will be, how was it that Arhats were given assurances by the Emancipated One of their attainment of supreme enlightenment? How can all beings attain Tathagatahood without realizing the truths of Parinirvana? Again, that borderline, that wall of attachment, of entanglement, how can you be human and yet is Buddha-ness not human? Still Mahamati's, right? This is a step too far, seemingly. How do you resolve that? So in chapter 7, we will dive into that. Just the same question, just more minutiae, right? Thank you for listening. Totally grateful to you guys. Patrons, those of you who send, whether it's incense or candles or money, to help keep this channel alive, keep it going. You guys are incredible. We're all appreciative for you guys. Truthfully, Namo Myoho Renge-kyo. Buddha revolution, Buddhist revolution. Yeah? Personal, societal, universal. Thank you for being here. I'll see you in the next one. Time. It's a strange thing, isn't it? All right. Bye for now.